Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Held on November 24th, 2019, in conjunction with the exhibition The Eye of the Sun, 19th Century Photographs from the National Gallery of Art, the lecture Before the Kodak Girl explores the many roles that women played in 19th century photography. From working in major studios to producing photographs as professionals and amateurs, women were deeply involved in the medium's first half century, though histories and collections of photography tend to emphasize only a few extraordinary examples. Kara Felt illustrates the diverse contributions of women, highlighting a selection of known and relatively unknown figures, while discussing the factors enabling and limiting their advancement. Ultimately, the lecture illuminates the emergence of photography as a central interest of the modern woman in the 1890s, when Eastman Kodak launched a highly successful campaign to sell its products through the imagery of the independent, camera-toting Kodak girl.
The World's Columbian Exposition, also known as the Chicago World's Fair, attracted an estimated 27 million visitors over its six-month run in 1893. And has been remembered for its industrial, social, and artistic optimism. With its monumental sculptures and Beaux-Arts buildings painted a gleaming white, the World's Fair disseminated the ideas of the City Beautiful movement. As part of its embrace of progress and modern technology, the exposition included a huge amount of photography, from a dedicated photo building to elaborate displays of photographs within other pavilions. The fair especially promoted female photographers, presenting work by some 20 women, both devoted amateurs and professionals alike. Frances Benjamin Johnston, the photographer of this image here, a DC-based photographer who tirelessly championed her female colleagues, was one of three photographers hired by the government to extensively record the exposition. It was in this grand and splendid setting that George Eastman, founder of Eastman Kodak, launched an advertising strategy that soon featured in posters and magazine illustrations worldwide. Kodak girls cut striking figures immediately. Holding the latest Kodak No. 4 camera and posed in front of the fair's art galleries to create an aura of refinement and high culture, they lean inquisitively into the view before their lens. The companions are stylish young women, wearing dresses with striped accents and mutton sleeves, which have become fashionable for allowing greater freedom of movement. As the scene suggests, the camera in their hands gave these women a powerful outlet for pursuing their curiosities in the public sphere. This illustration formed the basis of a highly successful campaign over the next 80 years. Where young, independent women, often shown wearing sporty stripes and on the move in outdoor settings, became powerful images of the modern photographer. Kodak ads gave photography a female face, while helping to attract millions of men, women, and children to the medium. The company shrewdly recognized that female consumers were likely to be a key amateur market, since they were more often at home to photograph family. Before long, as we can see, in the advertisement from 1909, women helped their children become their own photographers. Kodak quickly became a verb, and from the 1890s, photography became linked with bicycles as a technology and even a sport, heralding new freedoms and increased mobility for women. Camera clubs organized cycling trips to take pictures, and in 1897, Eastman Kodak again employed a young woman to advertise a camera made for use on bicycles. One of the last Kodak girls, modeled here by Sybil Shepherd in 1972, one of the best finds in my research was Sybil Shepherd, testifies to the staying power of this image of an athletic, bike-riding female photographer, even as hemlines had clearly changed by about a mile. As the leading American photographer Alfred Stieglitz saw it, in the 1890s, amateur photography and cycling were both unserious fads and crazes, which made their symbolic connection with women revealing. Indeed, as much as the woman photographer in these ads was an emblem of liberation, she was not entirely emancipatory. As I will argue today, rather than simply promising new possibilities of self-expression for women, the Kodak Girl also helped conceal women's significant participation in photography's first 50 years by associating them with the image of a novice. Kodak was specifically designed for its ease of use, so memorably captured in the company's slogan, "You push the button and we do the rest." In other words, the technology was so simple, even a woman could do it. Kodak's simplicity inscribes many of these ads. The Kodak Girl was chosen not only because her good looks and youthful energy could help develop emerging amateur markets, but also because women made more convincing newcomers to photography than men. Before the early 1890s, women in photography had been relatively invisible, often relegated to behind-the-scenes roles, and their perceived inexperience primed them to act as operators of cameras that were engineered to be effortless. At a moment when clearer distinctions were developing between professional and amateur photographers, women were firmly placed in the latter category. But were women novices in photography? Certainly most were. But as I'll discuss today, the number of women in professional and committed amateur photography was higher than Kodak ads would lead us to believe. After all, as I mentioned, female photographers played active roles at the very World's Fair where the Kodak Girl debuted. While this seems like a contradiction, the coexistence of advertisements of women that were called button pushers and the real presence of serious women photographers at the World's Fair captured the scope of female photographic practice at the turn of the 20th century. My talk this afternoon seeks to understand what the Kodak Girl minimized by uncovering some of the many women in photography who predate her. Histories of photography's first half century, from the announcement of its invention in 1839 until the debut of the Kodak Girl in 1893, gives the impression of an all-male domain, peppered by a few outstanding female practitioners, like Julia Margaret Cameron. I revisited and questioned this commonly accepted view while working on the exhibition The Eye of the Sun, 19th Century Photographs from the National Gallery of Art, which focuses on the first 50 years of photography. I began thinking about the number of works in the show made by women, which by my calculations is about 7.4%, and wondering how this compares to estimates for how many women were working in the field. We do not have reliable data on the number of female amateur photographers, i.e. those who did not sell their work for profit. However, by 1890, women made up 11% of professional photographers in the U.S., which is an increase from 4.5% 10 years earlier. On the left, we see the numbers of professional women photographers in the last decades of the 19th century, and on the right, we have the percent growth, which we can see was really explosive after 1880, especially relative to men. And this is when the dry plate process made photography much more convenient and easier to handle. In England and Wales, we can observe that a significant increase in female photographers came even earlier, when the wet collodion process reigned in the 1860s. This counters the common assumption that women only entered the field in sizable numbers in the 1880s when photography became less messy. Women made up nearly 20% of British photographers in 1881, and as I'll discuss a bit later, women comprised as much as a third of photographers in other countries. Using the female photographers in the current exhibition as a foundation, I set out to learn about who these women and others like them were and why we have not heard more about them. Focusing on women not only reinserts them into the medium's early history, but also illuminates the many reasons that people came to photography in the 19th century, while foregrounding how photographic practice was often collaborative rather than the work of one sole individual. Ultimately, the women photographers I'll talk about today give us a fuller understanding of 19th century photography while contextualizing the camera-toting modern woman circa 1900. So my talk today will be divided into two parts. In the first, I'm going to give a broad overview of women's involvement in photography between about 1840 and about 1890. examining who they were, where they were, and what factors enabled and limited their advancement in the field. And in the second shorter part, I'm going to highlight two photographers, one who's quite well known and one who's lesser known, who I think gives some human dimensions to some of these larger dynamics I'll be outlining in the first part. So many of you may know that when photography's invention was announced to the world in 1839, it was through two rival processes. First, the Frenchman Jacques-Louis Mondet Daguerre's eponymous photograph on silver sheeted copper, the highly detailed daguerreotype, an example of which you see on the left, soon followed by the Englishman William Henry Fox Talbot's paper negative and salted paper prints. And the Eye of the Sun has some beautiful Talbot salted paper prints on view, so those are very much worth going to check out. As Daguerre himself predicted in the first official statement on the daguerreotype, although the result is obtained by chemical means, the little work it entails will greatly please ladies. Disparaging or not, Daguerre was right, and women began experimenting with these new technologies right away. Talbot's wife, Constance, had an artistic background and made her own exposures and prints in the early 1840s, including this image of the first four lines of the Irish poet Thomas More's The Last Rose of Summer. The lines of type she pasted up in reverse and then printed by sunlight are an early form of photographic typesetting. 1 year later, her husband's watershed photographically illustrated book, The Pencil of Nature, would emphasize photography's usefulness in copying printed pages. Constance Talbot is the first example of a pattern we're going to see repeatedly today. Whether through their husbands, brothers, or fathers, women often came to photography through a male relative. One of Talbot's Welsh relations, John Dilwyn Llewellyn, made photography a familial pursuit at his estate of Penllyrgar, which we see on the upper left, and relied on his wife, Emma Talbot Llewellyn, to print many of his negatives for him. Here she is exposing a printing frame to sunlight out their window. Later, their daughter, Teresa, also made photographs in her studies of botany and astronomy, producing photographs of snow crystals and collaborating with her father on making views of the moon. The two women posing near the camera in Llewellyn's photograph on the right are most likely his daughter Teresa and either his wife Emma or his sister Mary Dilwyn. All of them were involved in photography. Dilwyn's photograph on view down the hall is a rare example of her work outside of British collections. She's generally regarded as the first female photographer in Wales. Beginning around 1853, Dilwyn made salted paper prints that depict flowers, birds and pets, and family and friends. She used a small format camera with glass negatives of about 2.5 by 3.25 inches, which shortened exposure times and enabled her to picture lively moments and intimate gatherings, such as this picnic at nearby Oystermouth Castle. Unlike the formal poses and austere expressions seen in most early photographs, Dilwyn captured lighter moods, such as in this portrait of her brother Lewis and his dog, as well as one of the earliest instances of what we now call photobombing. Even before Dilwyn, Anna Atkins learned about the invention of photography through her correspondence with Talbot. Trained as a botanist, she adopted photography as a scientific tool to record plants at her home in Kent in southeast England. She began making cyanotypes at the suggestion of her family friend Sir John Herschel, who invented this process using the light sensitivity of iron salts to produce vivid blue prints. Atkins made cameraless photographs of algae and ferns. The one on view is of a fern. By placing her specimens directly onto sensitized paper and exposing them to sunlight. Beginning in 1843, she privately published albums pairing cyanotypes with handwritten captions. These are often considered the earliest publications illustrated by photographic images, preceding even those by Talbot. As some of these examples from Britain attest, class often came before gender in determining who had access to photography in its early years. generally speaking, the U.S. did not have the same type of concentrated landed gentry with the resources to experiment with photography for scientific inquiry and for leisure. And so for that reason, we see far more commercial applications in this country, especially as it expanded to the West. By the mid-1840s, several women established and ran daguerreotype studios, including in New York, Boston, St. Louis, Leipzig, and Paris, as well as smaller towns and cities like Sleaford, England, and Karlstad, Sweden. These women were frequently at the forefront of photography's rapid technical advancements, incorporating new techniques and formats into their practice to cater to evolving markets. Amélie Guillot-Saguet opened a daguerreotype studio in Paris by 1844, and after experimenting with salted paper prints during extensive travels in Italy, she published a manual on the process with her husband. She initially trained as a painter, and recognizing that a shortcoming of photography was its monochrome, she began to hand paint her photographs to give them the lively hues of contemporary portraiture. According to available statistics, there were 8 female and 34 male daguerreotypists in Paris in 1848, so Guillot-Saguet was not alone. In mid-1850s France, André-Adolphe Eugène Dizdéry pioneered a format of handheld photograph mounted on cardstock the size of a calling card. His wife, Genevieve Elizabeth Dizdéry, was also an accomplished photographer who ran a studio in Brest for nearly 2 decades, producing many of these so-called carte de visite. When the market for carte de visite exploded in the U.S. in the early 1860s, the activist and former slave Sojourner Truth recognized a business opportunity and tool to promote a dignified image of African Americans. After escaping to freedom in 1826 and adopting the name Sojourner Truth in 1843, she became a central figure in the abolitionist and women's rights movements. In order to raise money for these causes, she sold her photographic portrait with the slogan, "I sell the shadow to support the substance." Beginning in 1864, so the year that this photograph comes from, she copyrighted her image, allowing her to control and profit from photographs that she advertised in newspapers and sold by mail and at her lectures. At the time, it was completely unprecedented for the sitter of the photograph rather than the photographer to receive money for the sale of the image. Though Truth is technically not the photographer here, she hired an unknown operator to expose the negative and make the print. She commissioned the photographs, very consciously styled herself before the lens, and owned the copyright. So she's very much using photography, even if she's not exactly the photographer. The work on view down the hall is her most ubiquitous portrait, with flowers connoting her gentility and knitting demonstrating her industriousness. As the art historian Darcy Grimaldo Grigsby has convincingly argued, Truth is very much the author and creator of these photographs, and they became a very important sign of her own rights and freedom. The women discussed thus far came to photography for a variety of reasons, as a livelihood, a record of one's surroundings, a vehicle of enfranchisement, and a form of creative expression. This latter category was most prevalent among the aristocracy in the UK, where Queen Victoria's great enthusiasm for photography made it an acceptable and engrossing pastime for women of the leisured classes. Among her closest courtiers, and actually a bridesmaid at her wedding, was Viscountess Frances Jocelyn, who turned to photography in 1858 after her husband's death. Picturing her family and friends in domestic scenes, she joined the Photographic Society of London and submitted her acclaimed landscapes to exhibitions in the 1860s. Positioning her camera so that it would not be caught in the mirror in this scene here, Jocelyn's image of a drawing room is full of ambiguity and muted drama, as the woman turns her back to the seated man and draws close to the fire. Jocelyn also created private albums filled with collages made from cut-up photographs pasted onto paper and embellished with drawings in watercolor. These were sophisticated compositions full of wit and rich with reference. So this is actually her own portrait in the center of the archer's bullseye on the left. Photo collage was a very popular activity amongst Victorian socialites, including Georgina Berkeley and Lady Filmer in England and Lady Louisa Tennyson in Ireland. Lady Louisa Tennyson was also the wife of a photographer whose work is on view in The Eye of the Sun. Most of these photo collagists worked with commercially produced portraits, but Lady Filmer also made her own photographs. A recent acquisition that is not on view in the exhibition is a beautifully posed photograph of four young women by Lady Filmer, who is a distinguished London hostess and friend of the Prince of Wales. Another noted Victorian photo collagist, Maria Harriet Elizabeth Cater, largely devoted her album On View in the Eye of the Sun to the extended Cater family and her childhood home. This whimsical picture of a jester strewing family photographs on the ground undermines the staid nature of the studio portraits that Cater has cut out, while also speaking to a cultural moment when photographic portraits were being freely shared for really the first time, on a large scale. Hers and other Victorian photo collages are a very colorful and distinct contribution to 19th century photography, though until an exhibition at the Art Institute of Chicago in 2010, they were usually dismissed as eccentric domestic work. Beyond making photographs, women filled many roles within the burgeoning photographic industry by the 1850s, though many remained anonymous. This wonderful image of the Swedish photographer Rosalie Schielman presents a tableau of women engaged in different moments in the process of making a photograph, from Schielman at center removing the lens cap and making the exposure to her assistants polishing a plate and hand painting a print. Studio portraiture was a sophisticated operation with many moving parts. Women frequently worked in labs as retouchers who removed spots, finishers who mounted and burnished prints, and hand colorists. Beyond behind-the-scenes work, women also served as waiting room attendants who greeted customers, took payments, and kept the studio's books. Their presence at the front of house was widely thought to soothe clients, especially children. In an 1873 article, the well-known British photographer Cornelius Jabez Hughes estimated that women comprised one-third of all photographic assistants. In his words, photography is an occupation exactly suited to the sex. There are no great weights to carry, no arduous strain of body or mind. It is neat and clean and is conducted indoors. There are other portions of the work, he continued, where the neatness of habit, the nimbleness of manipulation, and delicacy of touch of the female assistant is superior to the male. This is typical language for the time, when even support for women professionals was expressed through essentialist ideas about their inherent strengths and weaknesses. We know from contemporary reports that large numbers of women worked at major photographic firms, such as Louise Désirée Blanchard Evrard's establishment in Lille in France, and the Anthony brothers in New York, and later Eastman Kodak and the Lumiere brothers in Lyon. The 19th century was largely the era of albumen prints, and women were so frequently employed handling the delicate process of separating egg whites to use as the albumen binder that the feminine French word albumineuse began to describe these women in the late 1850s. However, women were mostly shadow workers, not singled out in an official capacity in city directories, and at least in the US, the practice of census taking did not recognize these occupations until 1880. Another reason that women were usually left out of photographic history stemmed from the lingering assumption that photographs are the products of a single, in this case usually male, individual. We can only begin to recognize women's labor once we acknowledge that photography, especially studio photography at this time, was an intricate and often collaborative process involving many people, only one of whom receives the credit. This was often true for amateurs, and it was almost always true for professionals. Their relative invisibility notwithstanding, there were some important factors enabling women's advancement in photography. Many publications about professional possibilities for women, including several books by the American economist Virginia Penny in the 1860s and 70s, mentioned photography as a solid option. One reason, as Hughes put it, was that photography is a field unsurrounded with traditional rules, with apprenticeship, with vested rights, and it is one which there is no sexual hostility to their employment. Photography was more accessible to women than established artistic fields like painting and sculpture because it was new, and thus it was free from conventional training and guild systems. The art historian Linda Nochlin famously argued in 1971 that it was social institutions that kept women from achieving artistic greatness, namely their exclusion from many art schools and total prohibition from drawing live from nude models, which was a linchpin of academic training. Though Nochlin's discussion mainly centers on painters and sculptors, she mentions that 19th century women excelled in literature because writing can be practiced at home and does not demand developing a repertoire of skills and iconography in an official setting. And I think similar conditions also favored the work of female photographers. It was relatively inexpensive to start, and it could be practiced at home with makeshift darkrooms in closets or bathrooms. Though the process could be and was most often learned from books or manuals, schools also offered instruction. Women were roughly 40% of the student body at Western New York's Chautauqua School of Photography in 1890. The lack of precedents and established ways of doing things made photography an open field. This accessibility benefited men joining the profession from different ranks and backgrounds, but it was especially advantageous to women. My research suggests that Scandinavia seems to have been by far the most encouraging environment for 19th century female photographers, and that's why I keep on coming back to this image. There are various explanations for this, including relatively permissive labor laws and a growth in the percentage of unmarried women. Across the world, most women who became professional photographers either never married, had been divorced or widowed, or practiced their craft before marriage and subsequently gave it up. Beyond these demographic factors, Scandinavian countries in these years were less industrialized, with more egalitarian attitudes toward female participation in the labor force. The historian William Culpdera found that in the US during the same period, the highest concentrations of women photographers were actually in the Midwest, not on the East Coast like you might expect, especially in states like Illinois and Minnesota that had very large numbers of immigrants from Scandinavia. Indeed, professional female photographers seem to have been most successful in frontier and developing communities rather than in more established capitals or centers. Already in the 1860s, there were 15 women amongst 100 registered photographers in Sweden. Berta Valerius was a portrait painter who studied photography in Paris and opened her studio in Stockholm in approximately 1862. She became the official photographer of the Royal Swedish Court 2 years later, and her portrait of Queen Josefina Maximiliana Eugenia is on the right. Looking to support her three children after her husband's death in 1864, Rosalie Schumann took over a studio and quickly became one of the most respected photographers in Stockholm. She began producing carte de visite, some of which employed collage techniques, and later larger cabinet cards. Schumann opened branches in Kalmar, Halmstad, and Vaxholm, and employed 10 assistants, most of whom were women. It is striking that she advertised her business with images of industrious women. This kind of female labor in photography is exactly what the Kodak girl downplayed 30 years later. Beyond studio portraiture, Swedish women also worked in the field of scientific inquiry. The photo historian Eva Dahlman has extensively studied Lawton von Dubin, a Swedish photographer who worked with her physician husband to illustrate his catalog on the Sami people in Lapland. Made with stereo, so that's the two images you see that produce a three-dimensional image when looked at through a viewer or with crossed eyes, actually. Made with stereo and full plate cameras in frigid conditions during expeditions in 1868 and 1871, her photographs are technical feats that demonstrate an awareness of the developing idioms of ethnographic research by representing her subjects in frontal and profile views. The way she portrays her subjects departs radically from the refined manner we have seen in which Europeans and Americans pictured themselves. Von Dubin also photographed lab artifacts, as well as landscapes. Her images form the basis of woodcuts illustrating her husband's 1873 book, which became a classic study of the Sami people. Danish women entered the field in the early 1850s. By 1880, scholars estimate that one-third of all professional photographers in Denmark were women, along with the unknown number of women employed in printing and retouching. For comparison, in the U.S., women made up 4.5% of photographers in 1880. Mary Steen was amongst the preeminent Danish photographers and was the only one to send her pictures to the World's Fair in Chicago in 1893. She was a committed suffragette, and she employed virtually only women in her Copenhagen studio, which she opened in 1884. And in the 1890s, she actually went to work for the British royal family. Though circumstances such as relative accessibility encouraged women's success in photography, they certainly faced their share of constraints. Even if women were legally allowed to gain employment, traditional gender roles and the ideal of domesticity often dictated that they stay at home. Though he supported women working as assistants, Hughes wrote in 1873, "There are certain portions where ill-smelling chemicals and dress-disfiguring solutions are used that are better conducted by the rougher sex." This perspective changed somewhat when dry plates became available in the late 1870s and lightweight hand cameras came on the market in the 1880s. Before then, the sheer bulk and size of photographic equipment and portable darkrooms physically favored male practitioners. A Punch cartoon from 1853 encapsulates early attitudes towards female photography enthusiasts. The face of the young woman at center is stained with photographic chemicals as her mother implores the shopkeeper to remove the silver nitrate smudges before her social engagement that evening. The image of a careless woman saved by a man's intervention reinforces the idea that women were inept at photographic chemistry. Even as late as 1887, an article called Woman's Work in Photography stated that women's talents lay rather in thimble and pencil than in developer and plate. In other words, women were useful for sewing the dark cloths that were necessary for keeping photographic materials sealed from light and for labeling prints and taking down, accounting information and all of that, but not for working as photographers themselves. Expectations of gender largely dictated the work that female photographers could do. Certain themes were considered off limits, especially those that involved distant travel, such as war and survey photography, while others that could be practiced at home, like interiors, portraits, and still lives, were far more acceptable. An article in Anthony's Photographic Bulletin from 1885, for example, extols amateur women photographers for capturing more natural portraits of family at home than a professional photographer could ever do in a studio, which often rendered these somewhat stilted pictures. There were also institutional barriers, with admission to some societies and photographic clubs restricted, as well as separatism within exhibitions if women were admitted at all. For example, in the Photographic Society of Philadelphia's 1886 exhibition, women were confined to 3 out of 37 sections. In the late 1880s, the American photographer and lecturer Catherine Weed Barnes campaigned against women's exclusion from clubs and exhibitions and argued for their acceptance based on merit rather than sex. One of her articles reproduced an American amateur photographer in 1889 implored photographic societies, "Give us a fair field and no favor. Let us win our spurs side by side with our brothers, and the result thus gained will be worth all the trouble required. The day is coming and will soon be here when only one question will be asked as to any photographic work, is it well done? The American photographer Walter Spreng found in his 1893 survey of camera clubs that women made up 7.6% of members in American clubs and only 3.2% of members in British clubs, but these numbers were growing by the century's end. Undoubtedly, women photographers faced numerous obstacles in the 19th century, and they continue to present difficulties for contemporary researchers trying to study them, as I can personally attest. First, there are archival issues, like the difficulty in establishing accurate numbers of practitioners and a comprehensive view from relatively scattered data points. As I mentioned, censuses are unreliable, and we know of several female photographers with careers spanning decades who were not listed as photographers. Often women's work went uncredited, and their positions as assistants to their fathers, brothers, or husbands went unrecorded. In one article about women artists in 1900, the writer quipped, "The chief object to a woman's success is that she can never have a wife." Add to this that it is harder to trace women than men because they almost always change their names during marriage, and their professional lives were often interrupted or derailed by childbirth. If women were unmarried and childless, as was the case for many female photographers, like I mentioned, often there was no obvious candidate for keeping their archives and preserving their legacies. Different issues faced amateur photographers who usually produced smaller numbers of photographs that were sometimes deemed unimportant and thrown away. Then there are historiographic issues. One of the first books to cover early American photography, Robert Taft's Photography in the American Scene, asserted that photography was left to hardier souls than women. Taft wrote that the society lady must have looked with considerable disfavor upon the sticky collodion and with still greater dismay at the dark stains produced on lily-white hands. The Museum of Modern Art curator Beaumont Newhall's classic book, The History of Photography from 1839 to the Present, includes only photographs by the two most famous 19th century female photographers, Julia Margaret Cameron and Lady Clementina Hawarden. Literature on early women photographers has expanded greatly since the 1970s, yet when so much scholarship on 19th century photography centers on images of war and exploration, studio practices have received short shrift. The sidelining of commercial work has had the effect of further marginalizing women who often worked as professional portraitists. Now that I've painted a broad overview of 19th century female photographers, I want to shift gears and speak in more depth about two notable women, one of whose work is in the exhibition down the hall and another's who is not. The first is Julia Margaret Cameron, who in 1860s England pioneered a unique style that has justifiably made her the most celebrated female photographer of the 19th century. Full stop, almost, you know, one of the most celebrated photographers of the 19th century. The second is Hannah Maynard, an English-born woman who immigrated to Canada and made experimental portraits from her highly successful commercial studio. In many ways, Cameron is the exception that proves the rule. A confluence of factors has secured Cameron's enduring fame between her groundbreaking artistic vision and singular style, her deep ties to the most famous figures in Victorian England, many of whom she photographed, and an enthusiastic audience amongst turn-of-the-century art photographers. Largely criticized in her time, Cameron only began to achieve wider renown when her niece, Virginia Woolf, and the art critic Roger Fry dedicated a 1926 book to her practice, Victorian Photographs of Famous Men and Fair Women. Immersed in the intellectual and artistic circles of mid-century Britain, Cameron manipulated focus and light to create poetic pictures rich in references to literature, mythology, and the Bible. Making unusual life-size portraits, she defined a new mode of photography that she intended to rival the expressive power of painting and sculpture. Her striking portraits of women are especially celebrated for the intensity of their gazes, with her self-assured sitters filling the frame with an almost spiritual strength. Her subjects included her family. So Julia Jackson on the right here was her niece and also the mother of Virginia Woolf, as well as her servants, and as well as the nearly all male literary and cultural giants of her day, including the painter William Holman Hunt, who was one of the founders of the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood of Painters, and the poet Alfred Tennyson, who was a neighbor and very good friend who posed for her frequently. Julia Margaret Paddle was born in Calcutta in 1815 and educated near Versailles before marrying the much older Charles Hay Cameron in 1838. The Camerons moved to England 10 years later, living in London with their 5 children and developing deep ties with playwrights, painters, and poets before moving to the Isle of Wight, which is just off the southern coast of England. When her husband traveled to Ceylon in 1863, her children gave her a camera as a Christmas present with the note, "It may amuse you, mother, to photograph during your solitude at Freshwater." At the age of 48, she threw herself into photography with her characteristic intensity. The playwright Henry Taylor once described Cameron as someone who lives upon superlatives as her daily bread. Transforming her estate's chicken coop into a studio, she enlisted family and friends to pose for her. As she related in a brief autobiographical statement later, "I should have been banished from any less indulgent household." By January 1864, she achieved her first success, a portrait of a reverend's daughter. This early picture of Cameron's chambermaid, Mary Hillier, and 2 neighbor girls is related to her first extended series. Cameron immediately chose to align her photography with the highest realm of artistic production, religious painting, religious art, by borrowing the popular Italian Renaissance subject of the Madonna and Child. As she wrote to her friend Sir John Herschel, who introduced her to photography when she was living in Calcutta, "My aspirations are to ennoble photography and to secure for it the character and uses of high art by combining the real and ideal and sacrificing nothing of truth by all possible devotion to poetry and beauty." Her camera elevated domestic servants to the ranks of the most venerated women in history. The soft and slightly blurry image owes to the fact that Cameron did not adjust the focus of her lens in this initial period. Even later in her career, when she holds a style of differential focus with areas of sharpness and softness, she incurred the establishment's continual derision, with reviews describing her work as smudged, torn, dirty, undefined, and in some cases almost unreadable. As Cameron saw it, professional photographers, especially studio photographers, were too exact in their portrayals. In her words, they were in the market of skeleton rendering, whereas her softer focus gave faces and features a sculptural, more lifelike sort of fleshiness and roundness. Though they have sometimes been dismissed, her earliest photographs are fascinating demonstrations not only of her deep religious faith, but also of her evolving concept of how photography could be art. In her early work, Cameron embarked on what would become a major part of her practice, narrative tableau, or fancy subjects, as she called them, that arranged models in elaborate costumes and theatrical poses. A minstrel group, which is on view down the hall, features her young neighbor, Kate Keown, dressed as a medieval musician, holding a mandolin between her sister, Elizabeth, and Cameron's maid, Mary Ryan. With their props, dress, and expressive gazes, Cameron transforms her ordinary models into a scene from Victorian poetry. The photograph illustrates Christina Rossetti's poem, Advent. Cameron took a particular interest in children, and one of her later works on the right comes from a group of photographs of cherubs. To emphasize their heavenly origin, Cameron used either a candle or oil lamp to smoke the back of her negative's upper edge, leaving a fine deposit of soot on the glass that produced these cloud-like billows upon printing. In addition to her biological children, Cameron adopted at least 5 children during the 1860s, including Adeline Grace Cloughton, the granddaughter of her oldest sister. In June 1872, 10-year-old Adeline died after breaking her back in a tragic accident. Cameron set up a camera in front of the window, visible in a mirror in the upper right, and with a second camera made four photographs of Adeline on her deathbed. With high mortality and especially infant mortality rates, postmortem photography was an important genre from the 1850s, when it became common to photograph children as if sleeping. Unsurprisingly, Cameron's entry in this field was somewhat unconventional. Insisting on the magical power of her camera to immortalize her subjects in an ephemeral, ever-threatening world. Unlike Cameron, Hannah Maynard was a working-class woman who prospered from her photography studio in British Columbia. She stayed well-informed of photographic developments through subscribing to trade journals, but between the need to earn a living, her portrait practice mainly catering to ordinary sitters rather than celebrities like that of Cameron, as well as working on the periphery of active centers of photography, have all contributed to her relative neglect. Originally from Cornwall, she emigrated from England to Bowmanville, Ontario in the 1850s with her husband, Richard. When he headed west prospecting for gold in 1858, she began studying photography under a professional portraitist. In 1862, the family settled in Vancouver, and she opened Mrs. R. Maynard's photographic gallery in Victoria, which remained in operation for 50 years. This photograph features 9 self-portraits on curled paper, centered on one where she looks the modern woman with her cycling hat, and is emblematic of her later work that I'll discuss in just a minute. Incorporated the same year that Maynard established her studio, the port city of Victoria boomed during the gold rush. Portraiture was the mainstay of her business, and Maynard pictured the influx of settlers as Victoria transferred from a small fort settlement to an urban center. Working in the popular carte de visite format, she photographed settler families, miners, sailors, and children, as well as First Nation subjects, which satisfied growing markets for souvenirs and ethnographic images. Later, she became the official photographer for Victoria's police department, strategically placing mirrors to simultaneously capture her inmates' profile and frontal views. As her business flourished, Maynard began exploring more elaborate techniques. From about 1881 to 1895, she ingeniously rearranged the many portraits of babies and children she took each year, calling them the Gems of British Columbia, a play on the preciousness of youth, as well as tiny photographs popular in the 1860s called gem tintypes. She used these composites as advertisements for her work, distributing them to clients at New Year's and having them published in the American journal St. Louis Photographer. The sheer density of faces is remarkable, as is the creativity of the placement, like the British Victorian women photocollagists using cut and paste techniques before her. As we can see on the right, in later years, she began miniaturizing previous gems so that her images contained tens of thousands of portraits. These were not only novelty items, but they were also important keepsakes at a time of high infant mortality. Death came to preoccupy Maynard after the loss of 2 of her grown daughters in the 1880s. Around the time of 16-year-old Lily's death from typhoid fever in 1883, she began making photo sculptures or living sculptures. Covering her scissors with white powder or rice flour, she shot them against black backgrounds and then double exposed the plates to capture the pedestals. These and other experimental techniques were more than sleights of hand for Maynard. Her photo sculptures appear to fossilize their figures, draining them of vitality and freezing them permanently. With the girl playing with a bird on the left and mourning its death on the right, her photographs were meditations on the transience of life. Maynard incorporated photo sculptures within her gems and in the more elaborate multiple exposures she produced from the late 1880s to the mid-1890s. She created these by using a lens cap and or carefully covering portions of the plate to expose different parts separately. So the seams between these are sometimes evident, but she often used props to create these continuous links and further the illusion, such as this seemingly unbroken garland of flowers connecting her self-portraits here. These were technical feats that became increasingly complicated as figures came to impinge on one another's space, Notice the fan over her shoulder in the center. They also frequently express Maynard's almost slapstick sense of humor as she bursts out of the frame and quizzically looks upon herself. Maynard used composite photography not only to trick the eye into thinking her multiple selves truly coexist, but also to unite living and non-living members of her family in the picture frame. The boy seated on the chair here, who is doubled in the photo sculpture that he looks at, is Maynard's grandson, confusingly named Maynard, who came to live with her after his mother Emma drowned in 1888. The framed photographs prominently on display represent three recently deceased relatives. Her daughter Emma's picture lies on the floor, while a portrait of her daughter-in-law Adelaide rests on the easel, and her teenage daughter Lily's likeness hangs on the wall. We know that Maynard attended a seance and meetings led by spiritualists, a community of believers who purported to communicate with the spirits of the dead, often through mediums. Spirit photography, a hugely popular phenomenon from the 1860s through World War I, used double exposed prints to bring sitters into communion with the spectral image of the recently departed. Maynard took this technique and ran with it, combining multiple exposures with photo sculpture and photographing photographs to create a memorial to her late daughters and daughter-in-law, one that pictures her and her grandson in the act of remembering them. I end by returning to where we started, to 1893, when the Kodak girl made her debut. As we have seen today, the female photographer in these ads did not appear out of thin air, but rather came into view at a time when women had to some extent arrived and were continuing to gain prominence in the field due to several technical, social, and cultural factors. At century's end, women discovered greater options with increased educational opportunities, affordable domestic help, and time-saving advances like the home sewing machine and canned foods. Economic prosperity spiked, leading to a substantial increase, especially in American women photographers. Referring to the camera apparatus, one writer stated in the magazine Outing that by 1890, the head under the dark hood as often boasted braided tresses as close-clipped locks. According to the author, woman waited and hoarded her strength, and today she finds the medium through which she expresses her conception of art. Our greatest painters have been men. Have we not a right to expect that our famous photographers will be women? This hope seemed to be becoming reality. For in the 1890s, Gertrude Kasebier, Emma Farnsworth, Zaida Ben-Yusuf, and Eva Watson-Schutz were some of the most famous artists in the growing movement for photography as art known as pictorialism. Across the world, women like the Norwegian photographers Bolette Berg and Marie Høeg began to flout the expectations of their gender, smoking cigarettes, wearing masculine clothing, and engaging in activities coded as masculine. Operating a camera, especially to represent oneself or other women, formed part of a broader drive for self-determination, quickly becoming a fixture of what became known as the new woman. In her article of 1897, What a Woman Can Do with a Camera, Frances Benjamin Johnston outlined the necessary requirements for female photographers, namely good common sense, unlimited patience to carry her through endless failures, equally unlimited tact, good taste, a quick eye, a talent for detail, and a genius for hard work. 3 years later, Johnston curated an exhibition of women photographers that traveled from Paris to Moscow and Washington, D.C. That same year of 1900, the Boston-based photographer F. Holland Day organized a very important exhibition, the New School of American Photography, for venues in London and Paris. His exhibition featured almost 50% women. Needless to say, this is much better than we generally do in art museums today. In retrospect, the Kodak girl emerges as an icon caught between modern progress and Victorian traditions, one who represents desires and anxieties surrounding the place of women in photography, art, and society. While she undoubtedly promoted women in photography, she simultaneously minimized her. casting her as a mere button pusher and keeper of family memories at a moment when serious female photographers were becoming forces to reckon with. Thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.